Beyond Words on KCLU.
Greetings, my name is Fran Halpern, and this is Beyond Words. We're about to have a conversation with Robert Crace, author of wildly successful mystery thrillers, whose career belies that old saw about not crossing over from TV to novels. Readers and reviewers love his Elvis Cole Private Eye series, as well as the standalone titles he writes. About 20 years ago, after an envied run as a television and screenwriter, Crace decided to write novels. Let's discover why this author, who was about to be honored at the Santa Barbara Book and Author Festival, has attracted devoted readers, critical acclaim, and commercial success. Also joining us is columnist Susan Gulbranson and Fred Klein, co-author of the Film Encyclopedia, right after the news from NPR.
It's time for Beyond Words with Fran Halpern. Beyond Words is KCLU's weekly exploration of writing, publishing, and the creative process, whether you're a writer or a reader. And now, another edition of KCLU's Beyond Words.
Hello again. When we invite anyone to guest on Beyond Words, I go into research mode and usually feel quite smug about assembling the information and introducing our guest. This week, I'm overwhelmed, in awe, and wondering where to begin. Robert Crace, creator of Elvis Cole, author of 13 acclaimed books since the mid-1980s, and documentarian, the four-part, very much acclaimed miniseries, Cross of Fire. Wait, there's more. Great television and screen credits, Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice, Lacey, dozens of prestigious awards acknowledging his television scripts and novels, beginning with The Monkey's Raincoat, published by Bantam in 1987. And so here's Mr. Robert Crace, whose latest novel is 2 Minute Rule, published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome, sir.
Hi, Fran. It's great to be speaking with you.
That's good. Let's parse your life into three parts a la Gaulle. Born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you're a lad of 52 and have enjoyed success and critical acclaim for your novels. Walked away from a rattling good TV career, major writing credits. So we'll begin with now. Life as a novelist, also some of your books have been made into films. What is life as a novelist?
Well, Fran, it's a lot of hard work when you're all alone sitting in a small white room with your computer. I know that. Listen, it's my dream, and I love being a writer. I love my work and writing.
Hey, it's a job, right?
It's a job. You know, I would guess that. I mean, from what I hear from readers when I'm on book tour, you know, a lot of people probably think it's glamorous, and I guess the glamour part comes when a writer is on tour and there's a visible public presence. But most of the writers I know, myself among them, their days are spent slaving over a keyboard and trying to create what they create. For weeks and months on end, and it's a solitary profession.
And when you have a family and a life, you also have to have a life, and you have to really juggle and organize the time element involved. I know. I think we were kidding about. Okay, you get up at 4 a.m. and write standing up at the washing machine while the wash is going. Or you live in a stone cottage and you have somebody to sharpen your pencils or fix your computer.
Right. Well, you do have to. You know, you have to juggle. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. You know, when you're a writer, you're your own boss, which is wonderful. But at the same time, as your boss, you have to crack the whip and make sure you work. And you know, I'm married, I have a family. You can't ignore them, because writing in and of itself can become an obsession. I know it's an obsession for me. I can disappear for days at a time, locked in my computer, and you know, that's, you know, you have to make adjustments. You have to say, hey, wait a minute, no, now stop. I know you're right in the middle of this paragraph that's going gangbusters. It's like the best thing you've ever written, but you still have to drive carpool. And that's all part of the life.
Oh, okay. Then what happens then? Can you recall, can you put something in a little corner of your mind when you're interrupted and you have to stop in the middle of a real role? How do you re-up that?
You know, I think by never letting completely go of it, there's always a piece of the book, a piece of the character with you. My friend Michael Connelly has a saying I like a lot. He calls it being in the tunnel, and that's the way it feels when you're submerged in a book. You can think of that creative process as being a long tunnel. You're there all alone with it, you know, with your characters, with your imaginary world. But there are those moments, those times when you have to leave it, like, you know, being interviewed on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So you step out of your book, and you do what you have to do, drive carpool, talk to Fran, but there's a little piece of you that hangs on to where you were with your characters in that creative moment. And then when it comes time to go back to your keyboard, to go back to the work, that's the little piece, like a candle flame. It's still flickering there in the darkness, and you follow that light, you go back to it, you go back to work, and you're back in that fictional world again.
Well, do you depend on your memory, or do you have notes and an outline?
Oh, Fran, if you could see my office, you would be appalled. I have so many Post-it notes covering every conceivable surface. They look like scales on a fish.
Well, I usually before I let anybody into my office, so we probably compare and see who's got more little bits and pieces around. Say, if you've been inoculated against bubonic plague, you may walk into my office.
I understand.
It's well, you know, they say that a clean mind, a clean desk. Well, I must have a very dirty mind.
Yeah, my life is clutter.
Uh-huh.
But I do, I have to write. I know there are writers, I guess, who don't. I am an outliner. I think about what it is I'm writing a lot. And because I'm scared, I will forget all those things. I'm thinking, the notions and ideas. I write them all down. I do try to outline. I make notes on scenes. I make notes on plot twists, on characters and what they're feeling. Invariably, I end up grabbing whatever is handy paper-wise, and I keep stacks and stacks of Post-it pads around, and I just patch them everywhere. And sometimes I go back and look through them, and it's really the only way for me to remember what it is I want to write. Otherwise, there's simply too many ideas to keep track of.
And did you always work that way, or did that evolve?
I think it evolved to a degree. I've always worked that way. In the beginning of my career, way back in the dawn of time, when I was just a kid and teaching myself to write, I wrote short things. You know, I started as a short story writer. I wrote short articles and pieces that were never more than 12 or 16 pages long, and at that length, I really didn't need to outline or to keep voluminous notes. But you know, as my career progressed, as I started to write pieces that were longer and more complicated, you know, going from short stories into hour teleplays, and from hour teleplays into 2 hours. 2-hour scripts or miniseries, those things began to be, you know, complicated and detailed and ponderous, and I started keeping many, many, many notes. Mm-hmm. And then when I finally got to the point in my career where I was attempting to write novels, I mean, the novel is it's a large piece of work. It's a very complicated, lengthy, detailed structure. And there was simply no way I could keep it in my head. In fact, to this day now, I guess I'm a visual person. I need to be able to see the structure of the book. So one of my techniques is to write, I fill out file cards. I make file cards describing each scene or chapter. And I have in my office large cork boards, and they will be filled with these note cards I've made that sort of define the structure and the plot and the story of the book, so that I can literally stand on one side of my office and see the entirety of the book from beginning through the end, and that helps me, I think, to see what might be lacking or where there might be problems. But it's really the only way I can keep everything in my head.
A female novelist, successful novelist I know, has a clothesline out. She had, you know, the old wooden clothes clips.
Sure, absolutely.
She's got all her notes across the clothesline, which the same.
I hope
thing.
It doesn't rain.
I think it's indoors. Hey, listen, I grew up in an apartment house, and we did used to hang the clothes up on the roof, and it was always, oh my God, it's going to rain. Everybody rush up there to take the clothes and the sheets and the stuff. Another time, another world, another century, another ambiance. Let's stay with the work, the life as novelist for a while.
Sure.
You go out on tour. You are a successful novelist. Do you do the tour because it helps the career, and in part do you love to do the tour, or does it become a chore? If this is Tuesday, am I in Cleveland?
Oh, all of the above. Mm-hmm. I do tour for every book. Mm-hmm. And my tours are always extensive. For example, for 2 Minute Rule, I spent a month here in the United States touring. I forget how many. I think it was 17 cities here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And then I immediately went to London, and I spent 6 days, I think it was, in the U.K., touring there. And from London went to Italy, where I spent, I think, about 4 days in Italy promoting my books in Italy. So altogether, I was about 6 weeks on the road. I think I'm probably one of the few writers who loves touring. I've learned over time that to value it for many, many reasons. And one of the biggest, I think, is that it allows me FaceTime with my readers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were joking around earlier, but it's true. My life is most of the year is spent alone in my office, submerged in my fiction. The tour is really the one time of the year that I get to go out and spend time in bookstores, with booksellers, with readers, with other people like me who love books. And I find that enormously rewarding and great, great fun. It's very, in one way, it's very, very relaxing. Now, you know, of course, the downside of touring, just the hassle of going out for 6 weeks in and out of airports. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you do any flying these days, you know what security's like and all this other stuff. So you know, of course it's tiring, and of course you end up exhausted and frustrated, and there's a lot of little things that invariably go wrong. But I think the good far outweighs the bad, and I enjoy the experience.
And so when your New York PR representative puts you in San Diego and half the day later in Santa Barbara because they haven't a clue about the mileage.
It's happened to me. I can tell you. I give you a perfect example. This was several tours ago. I had flown into Chicago for some appearances, and then I was going to Milwaukee, and then after Milwaukee, Madison. Well, the agents, the publicists who had booked that particular tour, had never looked at a map.
Yeah.
And they had me. They flew me from Chicago to Milwaukee, and I made my appearance there. And then the next, as I said, was in Madison. So here's what they arranged: they were going to fly me out of Milwaukee back to Chicago, where I would change planes, and then fly to Madison for my appearance there. altogether, the travel time doing it that way was going to be about 6 hours or so. Well, it turns out that Madison, Wisconsin is only about a 50-minute drive from Milwaukee. So, you know, they were going to shoot a whole day having me sit in an airport, and had they looked at a map, they would have just let me have a rental car and I could have driven it. And when I discovered that, of course, I didn't know that was going to happen either. When I got to Milwaukee and discovered that was the situation, we had to make a change in plans.
Well, okay. I've over the course of watching, being involved in publishing, I know that all these wonderful glitch stories, which maybe there should be a book. Well, there probably is some. Well, when are the audiences different in Italy or London or New York? Are they different than Americans when they come out to your fans and people who love your books or people who just love to read anyway, who come out to the meet and greet? Are they different in any way?
In some ways, yes, but not. But they are all the same in the one core way. The readers, the fans who come out, the readers who come out are all, you know, they are all to a person people who love books, and they have that in common. You know, they're voracious readers. They love to read. They come out. It's my good fortune. I mean, they're coming out because they like my work. You know, culturally, you can see some differences, but you don't see it on an individual basis. And, and by that comment, I mean the European countries. I've learned a higher percentage, for whatever reason, a higher percentage of their population reads than the population in America. You know, readership in America. Is I think probably unfortunately a declining percentage. Most people watch TV and don't read. Now I suspect I'm not sure why, whether it's because of some sort of historical differences in Europe or their educational system, but a larger percentage of the Italians, the French, the Germans, the English. They read, they love books. It's funny, when I first went to Italy, what I discovered is the Italians, they treat writers the way Americans treat sitcom stars. It's a very much a difference in attitude.
I have a theory. Maybe there are two reasons. We are still very young people. We're still maybe learning our way through the world. And, of course, we have enormous distractions here. There are two reasons. I know in the European countries, even the teacher is more respected, and certainly the writer, Herr Professor, or the tutor and the writer. Yeah, they're looked upon with great respect. And as you said here, you have to, well, you're a celebrity writer, still gets the turnout. My last question about the tours, is it a variety of turnouts? You sometimes find out that only your mother's Mahjong club came out.
You never know what you're going to get. I'm very fortunate. I'm 13 books in. I've built a rabid, dedicated audience over the course of those 13 books, and so when I go out, look, I think it's been 13 books, probably 7 national tours here in the U.S. I've been embarrassed and humiliated in every conceivable way. And after that much experience, you know, I think kind of a perspective comes to it. So now I take it as it comes, and nothing is a shock. Nothing horrifies me. But at the same time, I'm at a place, thankfully, fortunately, where when I go out now, the turnouts are almost always very gratifying. Wasn't always that way.
Well, of course
not. Earlier in the career when I would go out on tours, You know, I mean, well, I give you a perfect example. I did a signing once in Pittsburgh at a chain bookstore, and you know, the chain people there were very nice. They had a podium set up. They had 50, 60 chairs set up. There's a microphone, speakers, all of these things. They bring me into the store, bring me up to the podium. There's three people sitting there. There's two women sitting on the front row, and there's a man sitting on the very back row with you know, bag of books. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't really sure what to do, but I felt silly standing up there at a podium with a microphone with all these empty seats and these three people. And so I got up there and I said, look, since, I mean, clearly we're a small and intimate group here, I feel silly standing up here. I tell you what, I'm going to come down there and sit. We'll all just sit together and we just talk for, you know, whatever, half hour. And so, I started to come around, leave the podium to go down to the seats. And I called to the man in the back. I said, sir, why don't, come on up here and sit with us. He says, no. and he wouldn't come up. I guess he was just shy. He had my books to sign, but he didn't want to have anything to do with me. So he sat in the back. So now I get down there and I sat with the two ladies. And I said, thank you very much, for coming. But, you know, here we are. So listen, you know, if let's just talk. If you have any questions about my work, Elvis Cole, Joe Pike, whatever, you know, ask me whatever you like. And they kind of giggled and laughed and looked at each other. And one of the ladies said, we don't know who you are. We just sat down because my feet hurt. True story. So I've seen it all. Thankfully, my turnouts are a little bit better than that these days.
If the head gets too large for the hat, you can recall that. Well, I want to quote a couple of critiques for you, and then we're going to move back to the television career. By the way, we're talking with Robert Crace, the author of 13 novels, Elvis Cole, Joe Pike, and then what we call a few standalone novels that featured other characters. Here's Victoria Skernick, editor-in-chief, Book of the Month Club, and she says, I read a literary novel last weekend for which the publisher paid millions and hated every word on every page. Then I picked up The Forgotten Man by Robert Crace and almost swooned with pleasure. Good writing. It can be there regardless of whether a book is deemed literary or commercial. And then Don Crouch of New Mystery Reader, our long national nightmare is over, quoting one of our presidents. Elvis Cole is back. The Forgotten Man is the first great mystery novel of 2005. We can't imagine many more joining its rarefied air. Crace has evolved and matured as a writer in a way that connects with the central nervous system of the reader. So, what a wonderful, after all those hours and days and months and years of toiling away, to have people say that about your work.
Oh, it's just, Fran, that's as nice as it gets. It is rewarding. Mm-hmm. It is gratifying. You know, I I've been around the block before. I've been writing professionally for, oh gosh, I hate even to say, you know, probably 30 years now. I can't be that old, Fran.
Since you were nine, I was nine when I had my first kid. So
there you perfect. I'm going to remember that answer, Fran. I'm going to use that. But with all the writing I've done, even though, you know, yes, I'm not an idiot. I recognize the books do well. People mm-hmm. like the books. I know that. But when I'm writing a book, when I'm lost in the process, truthfully, honestly, I don't know what I have. I never know if it's working, if it's failing. Part of the process for me. Invariably, what I see in my work as I'm creating it are the failures of it. You know, the moments that don't work, and I'm trying to make them work, and I never know whether or not I've been successful. So by the time I get to the point where the book is published, when you receive reviews like that, it's really the first indication of whether or not you've been successful. To get comments like that made about your work is rewarding, it's gratifying, and it's also a heck of a big relief.
I certainly also, as a writer and observer of writers, I really understand. You're not sitting back and saying, oh, I'm writing another great American novel.
No, it's nothing like that at all.
We torture ourselves generally.
Yes.
I really believe we do. Oh, this is not going to work. They're going to hate it. Or, yeah, the whole nine yards. Okay, we're going to go backward a little bit now. The television career. You arrived from your home state, from Louisiana. You went to Hollywood. And there's always that little paragraph in between that I want to find out about, and then you were writing for, you had major writing credits in TV for Hill Street Blues and Miami Vice and Lacey. How does that happen? How'd you crawl over the wall?
I'm not sure how it happened either. I got lucky.
Uh-huh.
Let me back up
a
half a step to set the context.
Okay.
I've wanted to be a writer since junior high school, and I started writing things, everything, at about that time, however old you are when you're in junior high school, you know, what, 12, 13, 13, I guess, 13 or 14.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And when I say by writing, what I was doing, I was writing short stories, I was writing my own comic books, I was just... Mm-hmm. Writing things, trying to write things, and continued that constantly all through high school and then into college. I was submitting short stories to magazines and publishing houses and anthologies, trying to sell them, being rejected. And that was all, I think, my initial learning period. And I came out here only after I had made a handful of sales of short stories in the last year of my college. You know, before that, I never really thought, I mean, it was a fantasy, but I never really believed or thought that I could make a living as a writer. I thought I would do something normal for a living, and then the writing would be like a hobby. But when I sold the short stories, all in a period of my 3 or 4 months, after so many rejections, I started to think, well, geez, maybe I really can do this. Maybe, maybe I can make my living at this. And I've always been a fan of television, Hollywood. I love movies to this day, love them. I wanted to be a part of Hollywood and the creative process here. And, that's when I decided to come out. And the reason I gave you that preface is I think the writing of all those short stories, getting rejected so many times, really helped me in the TV process, because when I got here, I didn't know anyone. I had no contacts. I mean, I'm a kid from Louisiana. I came out here with a buddy of mine I'd met in school. He wanted to be a writer also in Hollywood. We didn't know anyone in the business. We had no context. I had never seen a script before.
Mm-hmm.
When we got here, there used to be, it doesn't exist anymore, there used to be an old bookstore in Hollywood Boulevard, Collector's Bookstore, and they would have this cardboard box there filled with cast-off teleplay scripts from whatever series were shooting at that time. And they sold them for $2.50 each. So, I bought three or four of the scripts. I went back and I read them, and it's like, okay, this is what a script looks like. And I then went to the Writers Guild, and I got the Writers Guild at that time would sell you like this little pamphlet, a mimeograph pamphlet for $1 there was a list of all the talent agents who were signatory to the Writers Guild MBA, you know, like quote-unquote real agents.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was out here for, by that time, you know, just 3 or 4 months, and I was starting to meet people and ask questions, and I called an agent who was on one of those lists, and I said, well, here's who I am. I'm this kid from Louisiana, and I've made a handful of short story fiction sales, and now I want to write TV. What do I do? And he said, I don't run a writing class. He said, yeah. You want to know what to do? Write something. Then I'll read it. I said, well, what, okay. Like a moron, I go, well, what do I write? He said, you idiot. He said, write your favorite show. Now, don't call me again. Hung up. Well, my favorite show at that time, there were a couple of them, but one of them was an old ABC series starring Robert Blake called Beretta. It was a cop show.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, I've always, you know, I write cop stuff, and I liked that show. So I wrote two scripts. They were the first two on spec. You know, I just made up stories and wrote them, and I wrote two scripts. And I called that same agent back, I said, will you read it? And he said, yeah, send them over. So I sent them over, and lo and behold, and believe me, no one was more surprised than me. He calls me back and like 2 days later, and he says, kid, where you been? These are terrific.
I guess the secret is good writing. The basic secret is to be able to write.
Maybe, you know.
And get lucky.
And be lucky, mm-hmm. and here's where I think the luck part of it does come in. It turns out, so he sends the Beretta script over to Beretta. He calls up a guy over there, a story editor named Sid Ellis, and he says, Sid, I got this script here, it's really good, and you should take a look at it. Sid says, okay. Well, here's how the luck part comes. It turns out that the producers of the show had been expecting a script, an assigned script to come in that they were counting on because they needed to put something in front of the cameras, and that script was delivered, and they read it, and it just didn't work for them. And now they knew they couldn't use it, and I think they were in a crunch, and they needed to get something in the camera, in front of the camera, you know, like the next week. And then Sid Ellis reads my script, and he thought, hey, this is pretty close. You know, we could make only a few changes in this, and it might serve. And they ended up buying my script. So part of the story is right place, right time. Was it a good script? I like to think it was. But, you know, the fact is I sold the second script I ever wrote, a spec script. And after that, the people on Beretta put me to work, and I wrote many scripts for them, and then my career in TV just sort of took off.
And did the gruff-voiced agent represent you?
Yes, he did. He was a terrific agent, a fine man, and he ended up being my agent for many, many years.
Now, and that story about when opportunity and readiness and talent get together, the timing, that's a story I love. Because, as you said, they needed something, and there you were.
Yeah, you know, it's all about. I mean, all anyone can do who wants to do this is work. And meaning, you know, is write. You write. You create product, and then you put your product out there. And you know, sooner or later, if it all comes together, then good things happen.
And in your observation, of course, you're writing the novels. Now, we're talking with Robert Crace, 13 novels, Elvis Cole, Joe Pike, a great readership, a great fan club. And you're going to arrive next week, Saturday, September 23, at the Santa Barbara Book and Author Festival. You're going to be awarded the Ross McDonald. You'll be honored as the Ross McDonald recipient. I think Ross McDonald, I know, was one of your heroes, one of your writing heroes. And who else did you love to read?
Well, I let me just say, you know, I write crime novels, mm-hmm. and I'm mostly known for my detective series, mm-hmm. Elvis Cole and Joe Pike. In the history of American detective fiction, you know, there are the big three. It's Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, and Ross McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
When I was first introduced to this genre, when I was a kid, those were the people I first discovered. Those were the people who fostered this passion in me for wanting to one day, you know, have my detective, create my detective character, to write in that genre, in that world, to use the fictional construct of the private investigator as a way for me to express myself. And Ross McDonald was and remains a master. He was seminal to the evolution of detective fiction in not only in this country, I think, but all over the world, all
right.
over the planet.
Mm-hmm. And he was a Santa Barbarian also.
That's right.
Yeah.
He
was a local lad.
Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm. Robert Crace, at this point, we will have to say adieu. Everybody and anybody and all of us and all of yous, come out next Saturday to the Santa Barbara Book and Author Festival and meet Robert Crace. And he'll be there speaking, signing his books. We're going to have a wonderful day. And we are going to go to a break after saying thank you very much. We could go on for another hour just about the process and the way you articulate the process of how you write and how you develop and what the writing life is like once you make it, when the dream comes true. We thank you very much. We're so glad that your dream came true and that you have been able to deliver to us so many wonderful books. Thanks again, Robert Crace. For anybody who doesn't know, it's C-R-A-I-S.
Fran,
look him up.
Fran, thank you. It's been a pleasure for me speaking with you. I appreciate it.